accession number 19772, reel 3.
Jim Farron, reel 3.
And his name was Jimmy Jumper, but he came out on the ID as Jumper Jimmy. I gave the personal effects to one of my colleagues who was going on leave to Japan before I was, and asked him to drop it off at the American embassy. I don't think he ever did. He kept the Ronson lighter, probably the dollar, but I never saw the wallet after that. I later wrote to the American embassy in London and told them what I'd found and what happened to the effects, and could any more information be given to me, whether he was living or dead. And back came a standard reply that any information regarding the armed forces would have to come through the armed forces network, basically. The Pentagon wasn't mentioned, but another authority was. But I never pursued it after that.
Any other incidents you remember from being in Korea?
The most frightening. Frightened over nothing, basically. I was on the reverse slope and nothing was happening at all. There was no stand to or anything. Broad daylight. And there is an explosion in a valley ahead of us. Not a big one, just a bang. And then a whistle of something flying through the air. And it hit my open combat jacket and lifted it away from my body. And I ran up the slope in about 5 paces. I could have done the hop, step and jump, I think, in record time. And then nothing else happened, and I just went back to see what it was, and it was just a piece of frozen ground, what I think it, a deer had exploded something in the valley, and the frozen soil flew all about. I was the only one that noticed it, all the rest were in the bunker or whatever. But it's frightening, the whistle and then the contact. I thought my time had come, but there was nothing.
Did you have any contact with the Koreans?
Not the forces. We had Korean porters. We had a cook. A man called Chan. He was in his 30s. I don't know why he wasn't in their army, but he was cooking for us. And he was a gentleman. He was older than we were, but he called everybody Mr. I was Mr. Hiran, because he couldn't pronounce F's for some reason or other. But he always showed me respect. And he had another porter with him. Should have been on full-time basis. But he was always going absent without leave, and they'd pick him up and bring him back. He wasn't in the forces, he was just a Korean porter, and probably being paid for being a Korean porter, and he just wasn't doing his job. And a third man I met who couldn't speak any English at all, and he wore a belt with a buckle of the Olympics, 5 rings on the Olympics. This man was no more than 7.5 stone, small man, He was expected to carry a box of ammunition across the side of the hill from the trailer to our position. He would carry two. And he was expected to carry a 4.5 gallon water can on his back. He would carry two. He was proving that he was as good as we were without the arrogance. He was happy doing what he was doing. And he and Chan, I don't even know this fellow, can't remember this man's name. But they were probably the first two gentlemen I was ever aware of. They were men and women and friends and whatever, but these were true gentlemen. They were there to do a job, they did a job. They never moaned about doing the job. They were grateful for us being out there. And I would have liked to have met them again after the war. But I can't even recognise faces of our own unit who were out there anymore. So I'd have a job remembering them after so long.
How did soldiers and Korean forces get on with each other?
Generally, very good. There was no discrimination. They, in the main, were glad we were there. We were glad to have them assisting. But there was the element that if they turned up to 355 to do our basic running about, and a mortar bomb or a shell started, if there's any kind of raid at all, they would take off, and that was their day over. They never ever came back. There might be one shell in the morning, one mortar bomb in the morning, but most of them would go. Two or three of them stayed. They were happy to be working for us. But I think the rest of them needed an excuse to go. But the people I was in contact, as I say, were gentlemen.
Were the Chinese enemy showing much aggression when you were there?
The Panmunjom talks were on. There was not a lot of aggression showed. We, in fact, the position we were in on 217, could see across the valley, and there were two Chinese soldiers. We spent a lot of time in the morning just outside the bunker talking. And at 19, we said to our sergeant, "Can we fire at them?" And he said, "No, because there's nothing happening. They weren't shooting at us. We were walking along the skyline normally. We were just going about our everyday duties, and they were doing the same." But when we moved out of the position and another section took over, the corporal in charge of them shot them or allowed his men to shoot them. But there was no, they were leaving us alone. And although some of us wanted to fire in anger, if you like, we weren't allowed to because there was nothing happening. And it wasn't till I was said going on leave at the end of April, that's actually a barrage on our position, a sustained barrage on a position. And we were told later that the unit that were ahead of us, the Chinese troops that were ahead of us, was just an ordinary battalion, and they were replaced by the crack battalion who attacked the clusters. So wherever they were before, they came back into the line, and that's when things happened, but not for weeks and weeks on end. It was just like 24 hours of aggression sort of thing. And we all kept our heads down after that. We never walked along the skyline after that, but say that was the end of April, beginning of May.
Did the bombardments do much damage?
The position we were on, 355, they called it Little Gibraltar, but the actual level on top was probably about 12, 14, 15 yards across. So any shells that were fired at us went over the top or fell short. A mortar attack would probably do a lot of damage because the mortar bombs come vertically down. But anything else missed us and went over to the top, over the top, where the reserve battalions were. They were supposed to be resting. And I think it was the Black Watch who were there for 14 days and lost 14 men because we were being attacked and not successfully. We were missing our positions because there was very little to aim at. We were all either on top of it or on the reverse slope, but shellfire would carry on a few more hundred yards and fall into what were the reserve positions, which should have been geographically safe because they were behind the big hill.
Did you ever fall sick whilst you were in Korea?
No. I was bitten by mosquitoes, apparently. No problems. We came back, arrived in Liverpool early December 52. Went to Cardiff to be demobbed. And they were issued, theoretically, with 3 months' supply of Paladrin tablets, which was to eliminate any threat of malaria. I religiously took one a day, but it wasn't 3 months, it was only 9 weeks. And I'd had to join the TA on coming out of national service for 3.5 years. I signed up for 4 and then got full pay. We had to do TA service. And in the March after we'd been demobbed, we had a weekend firing the guns up in Walkup, in Cumbria area. And it rained all Saturday, and we fired the guns on Saturday afternoon, and it rained all Sunday. We're still firing the guns. And then we travelled back to Birkenhead in a 3-tonner. Without a change of clothing. We had the poncho over us, but they never completely wore, well, they cover the parts that are dry, but they don't cover everything. And a few days after, I had a temperature of 106. And I was taken to the hospital. I had back pains as well. So they diagnosed it as meningitis. The temperature was 106 and 105, you're supposed to be dead. So they treated me for meningitis. And then the doctor did his rounds the following day. He said, you never told me you'd been abroad. I said, well, nobody asked me I'd have been abroad. And it was malaria. Well, that was one severe attack of malaria. And I never had it since. Although the when I gave blood after that, I had to declare that I'd had malaria in 1953. I suppose because the blood can be given to people who'd also had malaria. Well, that went on for several years. I always had to declare they had malaria. I didn't give blood for the first 12 months or so after coming out of the army. But then they said they could take blood, providing they listed as malaria contaminated sort of thing.
How do you feel now about having served with the Welsh Regiment in Korea?
I wouldn't have changed a thing, basically. As I say, they made us welcome in as much as they insisted, well, they told us we'd had no leave and we should have had leave, so off we went. You know, they could have hung on to us for a few more weeks to find out what sort of people we were. But they gave us the leave because we were entitled to it. And although I never met a lot of the platoon, because we were split up into four sections and allocated to different companies, and we were hardly in contact directly with the companies. There were about 10 of us in the section, and a sergeant I didn't particularly like. He wasn't a machine gun sergeant. We went out there with two sergeants. One of them, I won't name, went back, as soon as we were in Korea, he went back for an O group to be told the positions we were in and what was expected of us, sort of thing. And he got drunk. And the outcome was he wasn't allowed to return to the section that we were in the line. So he was punished by being in charge of one of the wings in the military prison in Japan. And the other man, he was a nice, cheery fella, a real jolly Welshman, was relaying the messages to us. And he said, gather around. And we had a round on the reverse slope of this hill. And he was going down to talk to us, and he slipped and fell on an empty can and cut his hand. So we took no further part in the action. He was there in charge of us. And I'd have been happy with him being in charge of us, but the two sergeants we took out there as machine gun sergeants were gone in a matter of days, both back to Japan. The corporal, Quick, took over our actual section. And then we later got a sergeant from one of the other companies who didn't know anything about machine guns. And a bit of a disciplinarian. Wasn't liked, but he wasn't bullying anyone. I think few of the Welsh Regiment's NCOs resented English members. I was doing a corporal's job, but I never got corporal's tapes for doing it. One man did become a lance corporal by saying to a new platoon commander how good he was. He was good on the machine gun, he was good on the radio, and he was a qualified range taker. He was none of them. He was adequate, but he was nothing outstanding, but he became a lance corporal. But I don't know of any other English NCOs in the unit. we had the platoon commander. Tried to form a choir, and he asked who was interested, and I was always interested in singing anyway. So we eventually got a choir. This was in Norfolk before we went to Korea, and there were about 16 of us, and I think there were only three or four Welshmen in a particular choir. And he got a good sound. He knew what he was talking about. He wasn't a particularly likeable man, but he knew his music, and he taught us all four-part harmony in a matter of days. And on the ferry going out there, we sang at one of the church services on the boat. We got to Korea and we split up because we all were in different parts of the Samichon Valley, basically. I was due for demob a few days before the battalion was due to end its service out there, and they went to Hong Kong, and he formed another choir up there, apparently. But he taught me a lot about music. I thought I knew a lot about music, but he taught me a lot more.
What did you sing, bass or tenor?
Second bass.
You were telling me earlier off the record that you didn't sing songs in Korea.
No. I wrote a poem about 169, and apparently when we arrived in Korea and the talks were going on at Panmunjom, which was about 6 miles or so behind us, and there was a searchlight shining every night to say these talks were going on. And the poem I wrote, four verses of it, changed a couple of names in it, because some people were actually, one man was actually crippled on patrol, so this 169. And the poem would have fitted to the tune of the Wild Colonial Boy. But the first verse went something like, "There goes another shell at it, I heard a comrade say. Means the chinks are firing at a hill not far away. It lies just straight ahead of us, between ours and Chinese lines. It's just an ugly death trap, but it's numbered 169. But I can't remember the rest of it.
Were you happy in Korea or not?
Yes, I was quite happy. Without realising, it's just we were there to do a job, we were doing it. And as I say, there wasn't a lot of aggression towards us. The occasional barrage, but we walked along the skyline when nothing was happening. And we knew they were out there ahead of us, but they were content to see how the talks were going, I suppose.
Did you have much contact with Allied troops?
Not directly, no. We occasionally had to go back and dig positions and reserve positions and things like that, and we passed Canadian camps and occasionally American. When we came out of the line from 217, we went back to prepare positions in a reserve position, and the Canadians, they were going into the line. I don't think they were taken over from us, but they were going into the line. And they had a bit of a party before they went. And somebody passed around a bottle of gin, with about a half inch at the bottom of it, and about 40 were supposed to take a drink out of it. So that's my only contact with Jim. They were a nice enough crowd. There was a patrol went out one night from the Australian Army, and they came through our positions to go into the Samichan Valley. And we were in our gun pits, but after they'd been out and come back, somebody was said they were talking to them, and they were saying something like, "It's a good unit, this, spoiled by a few Aussies," because they were Scotsmen and Scousers. In the book, The Soldier, they were always advertising for people to join the Canadian Army, the Australian Army, their adverts and things. I inquired about joining the Canadian Army, but I wasn't a specialist. A machine gunner wasn't a specialist. I could have been a driver, an electrician, or something. And that would mean a specialist. They didn't have to train me for anything. But they weren't taking just normal infantrymen.
What attracted you to joining the Canadian Army?
I don't really know. I was probably just impressed with seeing them out there. They all had fancy names. They were the Princess Patricia's regiment. And there's a gang that call themselves the Vandoos, whatever that means in French. Some of the youngs call themselves the Candoos. But that never appears to me joining their units. I thought, you get 10 years for sleeping on guard, it doesn't suit me. You make a mistake.